Hello and welcome to the 10th edition of the Roots Aviation Podcast. Today we're recording live from Roots Europe 2018 in Bilbao.
That's right, the sun's out and we've got an interview here with Ray Webster, the former CEO of EasyJet.
Ray, speaking as part of the conference programme sponsored by Embraer, talks to us about his life in aviation and the current low-cost landscape.
Here are his thoughts on EasyJet in the early days, Stelios' price tinkering and his view on the current market.
Ray also has some very interesting thoughts on the current long-haul, low-cost market. Ray was interviewed live on stage by Nigel Mays, SVP of Aviation Consultancy ASN. So, over to Nigel and Ray, and we hope you enjoy.
So, welcome, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Nigel Mays, and I'm the SVP at ASM. And I'm delighted to be doing the fireside chat with Ray Webster. So, I'm glad we're not in our pipe and slippers and sitting in front of a fire, but is what we wanted to be like is an informal conversation between myself and Ray. Now, Ray Webster was one of the earlier pioneers of low-cost travel in Europe and was responsible for basically developing one of the biggest brands, not only in Europe, but perhaps the world in terms of a low-cost carrier. So I'm going to take a seat and then we're going to get into the conversation. And so, Ray, you've just flown from all the way from New Zealand back to Europe. So you've got the rest of the summer here. What I want to start with is really understanding a little bit about those early days. Now you joined EasyJet in 1996, and you've been CEO. You were CEO for 10 years, and EasyJet had only been going for about 3 months at that time, and it didn't have an AOC, you were using an aircraft from Air Floil. So tell us a little bit about what the airline was like at that stage when you arrived.
Okay, so when I joined, we had use of two 737s that were operated by Air Foil, and they were flying to Scotland, to both Glasgow and Edinburgh. The airline really wasn't really an airline. It was a group of a few people that were focusing on pricing seats, running an accounts department. Most of these people were very young. They had some experience in aviation where it was necessary, but by and large, it was just a very, very skeleton group of people. The problem that Stelios had in starting up the business is that the chief executive that was nominated to join the company did join, but unfortunately he passed away very early in the process, and they were struggling to run the business. In fact, Stelios was really the only person that was there, but he wasn't qualified to act as chief executive. So they were in quite a difficult situation. And it was fortunate that I had a long career in aviation, which I started in 1965. And the last project that I was running back in Air New Zealand was to start up a low-cost carrier to enter the Trans-Tasman marketplace between Australia and New Zealand, because the two countries had agreed, Australia and New Zealand had agreed to deregulate airspace. Unfortunately, word got out that Webster and team were heading along the lines of a low-cost airline. The Australian government got lobbied by Qantas to stop it, and they did with a fax sent to the New Zealand government on a Friday evening and without any prior warning. So that was the end of the project that my team had been working on for about 3 years, and therefore I was looking for something else to do with a project that I was deeply committed to and I felt had a fantastic potential.
So it's the Australians' fault, basically.
Well, no, they triggered it. They triggered the opportunity, I guess, for me and for EasyJet to get together. It was interesting because I had a chat with Stelios, explained what I'd been doing, and he said, "Well, why would I be confident you had any knowledge of running a business in the UK, and as well, I'm not too sure that I have confidence in you in running an airline anywhere. So he said, touche, and can you get over here? So we had a good meeting, and the rest is history.
And what were the biggest challenges in those days for the business? Was it brand awareness? Was it operational? Was it the network development?
Well, at the start, we had very little to go on as a basis, which is good in a way because I had a clear slate to work with. We continued with using the airfoil AOC in the interim, and I started then to bring in people to set up a engineering and operational unit, which took a couple of years to complete, and focus then mainly on the commercial side. And the first issue we had to deal with was to get Celius away from pricing. He would be... in the early days, we were pricing manually, and he would have a look at the flights several times a morning, several times in the afternoon, and if he thought one flight was not selling quickly enough, he would drop the price, and then in the afternoon, he'd come back and mess around with it again. And we used to have lunch together, which was always interesting. And just before we went to lunch one day, I said, Stelius, what are you doing now? And he said, I'm just changing this price. I said, you changed that one a couple of hours ago. And he said, oh, did I? I said, yeah, not knowing it was true or not. And he said, oh, okay, well, you're in charge of your management now. So I said, okay. So over the weekend, I wrote I'm quite competent in coding. I wrote a program to actually set the initial pricing model into the system, which was fully automatic. So basically, it monitored the sales rate, it adjusted the prices according to the available seats left, and so that was the start of our automation. I think that was done in about week one of my arrival. So, I mean, it was that type of business where there was a lot of work to be done, and we just got on and did it. And over a period of time, we got more people involved that had the right experience to then take over the business.
And what about the network decisions at that time in the business? How, you know, you talk about the sophistication of, or the lack of sophistication in the yield management.
Yes.
And those early sort of days, there obviously wasn't a booking curve, and it sounds like you developed the tools for that. What about the decision making in terms of network?
Well, the most important thing was to actually get the AOC, because Airfoil had limited capabilities in terms of developing the business. We made an offer and acquired a company in Switzerland, which gave us the opportunity to operate outside the UK. So that was another component of the start. But the main thing was to really get our own operating license in place, so then we could bring our own aeroplanes in and set up a business that we could control directly.
And perhaps, you know, you've touched upon acquisitions, and you obviously purchased the business in Switzerland. You also purchased Go in those early
days. Well, that came a little bit later. We had discussions with BA, with Rod Ennington, and because Rod had a problem with a project that he'd agreed to start, and that Go had become a thorn in their side because of industrial problems with the main group of the BA pilots and cabin crew. And he felt that he didn't really want to continue with the project. He had to get... At that point in time, BA were having a lot of industrial problems, so he felt the right solution was to get rid of it. Stelius and I met him several times to talk it over, and in the end, Rod felt that it was going to be too politically difficult to actually allow us to purchase the company, and it was taken over by a private equity company, which we, sometime later, approached and negotiated a transaction to take over the business.
So that was 2001 that the Go acquisition was.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and what's your view on businesses, the airlines acquiring businesses to in order to develop?
Yes, I mean, I've always been very nervous about acquiring businesses because invariably there are differences in their attitude and politics can become a big issue. And also there can be inconsistencies between the business model, which ends up in complicating the business. And one of the things about low-cost airlines is that it's really, really important to keep things as simple as possible and avoid conflicts and deviations away from the business model. I'm not sure now exactly how Go defined its business model. I suspect it had spent quite a lot of time looking at us. And fortunately, when we took a look at the business, their value system and their approach towards running the business was very, very close to what EasyJet was using. We had to make a few tweaks, but very few. So the biggest problem we had was that in pitching for the business and succeeding with it, a lot of people in the senior levels of Go were very disappointed because they saw an opportunity of floating the company and becoming quite wealthy. And that clearly wasn't going to happen in the short term because we needed to combine the business, grow it for a number of years to get to the point where we were comfortable that it was harmonious and it was able to take the steps forward for the combined business to then float in the stock exchange. And in the end, that took us 5 years to get to that point. And that was 5 years because we had to wait for the two companies to come together and be properly fused together.
So and you purchased Go for, it was 370 odd million? But do you think that was the right thing to do at that point?
Well, the airline, of course, was based at Luton, which wouldn't have been my preferred choice because of a limited market in that area, local market, that is, good access into London. But we needed a bigger base to provide opportunity to grow into a much bigger market. So Stansted was a good option for us at that point in time. Gatwick would have been better, but Gatwick at that stage was heavily conflicted, if you like, from our point of view, and there were too many services operating there, not enough slots. If you recall, Gatwick at that time was primarily an airport was being used by airlines that were waiting for slots at Heathrow and a lot of charter operations. So it was quite busy, and we didn't feel that the environment was at that particular time was right to actually start services in that airport.
And you got access at that time through Go to bases at Bristol and East Midlands at that time as well. So you also got an immediate presence across other parts of the UK.
That's right, yeah.
So we've got Alex Cruz here tomorrow. There's rumours about British Airways trying to acquire Norwegian. Before we get off the subject of acquisitions, what would your advice be to Alex then?
Well, I think the guide advice on acquisitions is that to make sure that there's direct compatibility between the business models and importantly, the culture. If you don't get the two of those right, I wouldn't do it. It becomes very expensive and very messy because you end up with loss of control of your business model in that it's instead of having a very simple, clearly understood business offering and management model, you end up with complexities and conflict in the organization and also in the minds of consumers. So it's really not a good idea. A lot of airlines have tried it. They keep patching things together, but it's proven that you can perhaps be an owner of two companies, but don't try and put them together if the culture is not compatible.
I suppose the difficulty with British Airways is that, and IAG, is they're purchasing it not necessarily to match with British Airways, but to to integrate with Vueling and Level and some of their other low-cost brands. Yeah. So, you know, the way that they're going is probably slightly different to the way that SkyTeam and the Lufthansa group are going, where they've tried to develop their own low-cost brands. Do you think either way, either one is right or wrong? Is it better to go with the Air France model and developing Transavia and developing their own low-cost brands, or do you think IAG have got it right in terms of having their own brands?
Well, I think IAG obviously have a lot of experience now with low-cost. So I think, you know, they're in a bit, much better position to assess it. But, I mean, if you just to sort of wind back for a minute, when we acquired the Swiss operation, TEA, we kept that as a completely separate company. Yeah. The culture in Switzerland, as you can imagine, is quite different. It's quite conservative compared to the UK. And that was a very successful business for us. But we let them run their own business. We decided on what routes they should be flying. We then gave them the opportunity to then manage that completely themselves. And then we just use the common backbone of the commercial operation for selling and marketing. But and that's been a very, very good business. It's still running well today. It's got a very good team of people. And I think, as far as I can recall, all of the top management stayed with the company and are still there today.
Okay. Mm. Okay. Right. Okay. We'll move on from acquisitions and we'll get on to the low-cost model and the way that's evolving and the way the market is segmenting and the diversification. But just before we get on to that subject, there is a system for those of you that would like to ask Ray a question, the Menti system, and there's the details to log on to, and you enter the code 112445, and we'll come on to those questions at the end of the session. So let's get on to the low-cost model then. How do you think the low-cost model's changed? It's now 20 years since you started at EasyJet. What's changed in the low-cost industry?
I think it's quite worrying, actually, because we've had a period of very good economic performance. We've not had a serious downturn. We've not had runaway fuel prices as we've had in the past. There's been steady growth in the economy, and as a result, I think airlines, and I'm not referring to EasyJet in particular, but airlines in general, have had a very good run, and I think that they've been in a position where they've incrementally added to costs and losing efficiencies because there hasn't been pressure on them to address issues as it would normally be in a more normal economic environment. So I think that at some point in time in the future, there's going to have to be a correction. Fuel at some stage is going to change in value. If you look at the electric car industry, if it's successful in dramatically influencing the amount of fuel that's going to be used, clearly the producers are going to react. We don't know which way they're going to react, but it could be that they decide that it's time to put fuel up. Even though it's not going to create more money, they may as well get more for what they are selling. And so something like that could be absolutely have dramatic consequence on the airline industry in a very short period of time. We've been through that in the past, but I think some of those lessons have been forgotten or ignored. So that, you know, it'll be issues like that. The airline industry, if you track back for the last 50 years, there's always been peaks and troughs in terms of demand and in terms of pricing. And fuel for the low-cost airline is very, very, very critical. It only takes a few percent variation, and it can move the bottom line performance dramatically.
So, and in terms of what EasyJet are going through, they've said that they've had the best 3 years for over a decade. So you're quite right, the fuel prices helped, the strength of the economy has helped, Monarch and Air Berlin coming out of the marketplace. So they're in a great place at the moment. But the concern is the way, for you, the way the business model has changed, the way they're adding additional cost in. and hearing a little bit about the way that the business was in those early days, it seems like from your perspective that the focus on cost isn't as strong as it used to be.
That's my understanding. I'm not particularly close to the business, but just from observation and understanding of what is being contemplated and looking at the. I mean, I fly EasyJet today, so in fact, this week I flew, and just observing the turnaround times at an airport tells you a lot, and it's very clear that a baggage handling operation, for example, is taking probably 2 to 3 times longer on this particular occasion than it should have. And so to me, that sort of indicates that work needs to be done to actually correct those issues sooner rather than later.
And your opinion, when the market does go down, it's the ultra-low-cost carriers that will be in the best position to be able to cope with that?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, not always, because there's always going to be business travellers using low-cost carriers these days. So there'll be, it'll be shades, because you'll lose first, obviously, the ultra price-sensitive consumers, and people travelling on business are probably going to be in there for quite some time. But it puts huge pressures on the airline, and the most important thing with an airline is that you really need a very strong team of people to run an effective business. And if you get into a situation where you have to start laying people off, particularly in the management team, because the management team works as a very closely coupled network, it can be hugely detrimental to the confidence of the management team and the motivation of the group and whole when you have to start letting people go.
And we were talking earlier about some of the airlines that have done that well and kept focus on that low cost base. We'll talk about Southwest.
Southwest Airlines has got to be the gold standard really as a reference.
Yeah. And with over 500 aircraft, they show that having a year-by-year focus on cost seems to make the difference.
Well, it's been a very, very stable business. There's been very few senior management changes in its lifetime. So they've locked in the culture in the organization. And it's been in that situation for a long, long time. The difference in the UK is that it's very difficult to keep people for that long, and as it has been in the industry. I mean, even the big companies like BA tends to lose chief executives, quite frankly. If you go back the last 50 years, there's been a lot of them. That makes the situation that difficult, because whenever a new chief executive comes in, they come up with a different idea. They don't necessarily have the history of the business behind them, and you end up with the model being tweaked because they think they're doing the right thing, or someone else suggests, consultants are very good at this, coming in with an idea, let's rethink part of the business, change it. And over a period of time, you end up with this creep in the business model, which doesn't look to be very significant at any point in time. But if you look at it in snapshots over a 2-year period, it's very obvious that things have changed pretty dramatically.
Yeah, so continuity and stability are the things.
Well, if it works to start with, it probably should be left until it's proven that there's a problem, and then tackle that as a problem.
Was that, thinking back to the times when you was at EasyJet, there was Bars and Debonair, was that some of the failings that those businesses made, or was it just that EasyJet got it right?
Well, I think those businesses were poorly structured anyway. I think EasyJet obviously got into the market at the right time. We had, if you remember, initially... we were able to operate only in the UK. We acquired the Swiss carrier to give us an opportunity to get one step ahead of deregulation across Europe. So that gave us an ability at least to start services into Switzerland. And that model really didn't change from that point in time until the time I left. We basically just incrementally improved it. It was really then the opportunity to move into the EU markets that we then scaled the business, but again, we didn't change the model.
Okay, let's move on to long-haul low-cost. My view on this is that it's coming, it's evolving, it's now got new brands coming into the long-haul low-cost market. Mm. And you have a slightly different opinion, or you view this as we shouldn't be so enthusiastic about the long-haul low-cost model.
I'm really not a fan of it. I mean, I can see the opportunity, and it's good luck to the carriers, but I don't see it as becoming a mainstream market. I think if you travel long-haul, if you're traveling 6 or 8 hours, you want some comfort, and clearly for young people, for students, I can see great opportunity, that would be fine. But in terms of the wider mass market, I don't see that as being a major segment in terms of volume of business that they're going to get across a broad base of the consumers.
And you think that's because of the difficulties with getting the utilization of the aircraft and really being able to differentiate on cost? You talked about fuel earlier.
Yes.
Fuel is the same for a long-haul carrier, for a short-haul carrier. The cost isn't...
Yes, I think the thing is that, operating a large aircraft for long haul is much more efficient than a small aircraft. If you're operating a smaller aircraft across the Atlantic, for example, then... Which is inevitably the case if you're running it on a low-cost basis, because you're not going to fill a 380 or even a 787 probably with a one stop. So the economic advantage of the larger aircraft with the distribution of fares from the lowest up to the first class is inevitably going to provide a better economic outcome than a dedicated aircraft running just low fares.
So as a low-cost operator, airline such as EasyJet that's using Airbuses, the A321 LRs that will enable those longer sectors, your view would be, Don't start pushing the boundaries beyond that aircraft. If EasyJet were to order that aircraft, that might be a good thing, but don't start taking the boundaries beyond that.
Well, I don't. The thing is that the biggest determinant of the operating cost is going to be fuel. On a long sector, you're burning a lot of fuel to carry fuel, and that's the big issue. And you need some pretty high yields to cover that cost. That's the issue. I now fly to New Zealand every year on a 380 with Emirates, and the amount of fuel they burn on the Dubai to Auckland leg is just obscene because of the fuel that they're carrying. So that works because you've got some very expensive seats being sold up the front of the airplane. There's a lot of first class and business class seats, and that covers that cost. But if you didn't have that, it would be just economically non-viable.
So your view would be it'll claim a part of the market, but it's not going to be the mainstream. That's
what I believe.
That's your view.
Yeah.
Okay, so we talked about some of the challenges like fuel and cost control. Is there anything else that you think it will challenge the low-cost business within Europe? Other modes of travel, or are there other things you think?
Well, I think the big threat for Europe, really for aviation, is going to be high-speed rail. And France now, for example, apart from the south coast, has got a very, very good high-speed rail. And it's I used to travel to from Paris to Zurich every month, and the only way I would go there was by train. It was 3.5 hours, 4 hours, and city to city, no hassles. And that's typically the pattern that applies in France, that very few people will travel short haul from Paris on an airplane. It's just not attractive. It's a hassle getting to the airport. Then there's delays at the airport, where we can travel to, say, Zurich or even further afield with maybe time in departures hourly almost, just so convenient city to city. So that's there's a major program going on at the moment to extend the rail network, high-speed rail network, bridging France into Germany and beyond. So I think that's going to be a big threat to European-based air travel within the European continent.
So that will put the pressure on the carriers to look for longer sectors, and that's going to increase your average sector length. And you think that's going to be a trend throughout?
I believe that. That's my view. And I think it's the view of quite a few people, actually. But I mean, I think there's no comparison of travelling by train versus flying. I don't know how many of you are frequently on long-distance trains, but it's generally fatigue-free. You can get good work done. You're not told to put your case away and lock it up in the baggage compartment or whatever. You can just get on and get your job done, and you arrive pretty fresh. You can go into a meeting, get on the next, the train later back in the afternoon, whatever. So it's not really comparable to flying. It's a much more sophisticated product, and I think that's going to be a major issue for the continental airlines.
Okay, so this is my final sort of train of questioning. We're going to talk a little bit about the airport and airline relationship, and then I'll go to the questions that are from the floor. So we'll look at those. So if you've got any questions, please send them through. The last thing, the airport airline relationship. Just tell us a little bit about those early deals that were done either with Luton and the way the airline and airport relationship was back then. Was it quite simple? How much of a relationship did you have with the airports at that time? And just trying to think a little bit about how it may be now, given that we're at a route development event.
Yeah. Well, of course, when EasyJet started, there were a lot of airports that were very poorly utilised. Luton was just one. Stansted was a bit of a white elephant, as you may remember. Obviously, Heathrow was very busy. Gatwick was quite busy also. It was obvious that if you wanted to start an airline, you needed to go into the underutilized airports. So if you have a look at the way the low-cost industry developed, it was always into an airport that was underutilized. You could get some very, very attractive deals. Normally, a heavily discounted fare structure for the first 5 years or so. Maybe even longer in some cases. Ryanair will tell you that they got even longer deals than we did. And that was important because clearly the airlines at that time were fairly confident that their business model could be successful, but it was going to take quite a lot of upfront investment. There was also a lot of risk in that we didn't know how quickly the consumers would respond to a low-cost product, because you could have had consumers sitting there and say, well, if it's that cheap, it's probably dangerous. Others saying, it's good price, I'm going. So we had to dip our toe in the water and take it as it came. Fortunately, it did work. And so we had, I think we had a situation where the airline and the airports themselves did very well out of it. And as you can see today, Luton, Stansted are both very, very successful airports now, and continually to invest. So I think, you know, it's been a very good partnership. It wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for low cost. We think it's been really good.
And do you think in those days, was it, did the governments and the tourism authorities get involved in that process, or was it just an airport and airline?
No, it was just directly a commercial relationship between the parties. The CAA were helpful. We had no problems with them getting a license and operating. Government. The only time we got involved in the government was around 9/11, they were very good actually in calling the airline industry together to get people's perspective of what was going on. They were concerned that there could be issues that they need to know about, and so they participated with the airlines at that time. But once they were comfortable that things were okay, then they backed out again.
But the governments weren't getting involved in that process.
No.
So.
Well, if you recall, this was an era of privatization, so the government basically is relinquishing any direct control over the aviation industry. They wanted to make sure that the deregulation and the evolution of air travel was protected in the interest of the consumer, but they didn't see any need to get any closer to the industry other than just keeping a monitoring watch on it.
Okay. So we've got about 10 minutes left. I'm going to go through some of the questions now that we're getting on the Menti system. So keep these coming. First question, what impact will new aircraft technology have on low-cost carriers in the low-cost industry? Is it just the A321 and the 737 MAX that's going to make a difference, or do you think there's still going to be a role for the turboprops in the marketplace? Do you think anybody is going to be able to do it? Do the low-cost business model with a 777 or an A380? Mm-hmm. Is there anything radical that you think may be coming up?
I think that the model now is pretty well proven. There's been a lot of airplane options available, and these new technologies do provide some incremental improvement over the earlier generations, but there's nothing really that I can see that would produce a step change in economics that would make them that much more attractive. Clearly, a new airplane is going to be more expensive, so that's a factor that's got to be covered in the business operations, and hopefully the productivity of the new airplane is sufficient to cover that. So it's I wouldn't say it's a zero-sum gain, but it's...
Yeah. Some would say that's happening with the A350 at the moment, where people are saying it's an expensive aircraft. It's the economics are great, but it's expensive to purchase.
Yep, exactly.
So that's the key issue.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of investment going into developing a new aeroplane, so it's only right to expect that the company's probably going to want a little bit more money for it.
Okay, so another question. Ray, when did you discover the business travellers for EasyJet, and how did you approach them?
In the first 5 years, we weren't seeing any signs of any business. It was considered to be low cost, cheap and nasty, and we were happy with that because the important thing was that we needed to fill the aeroplanes to start with.
So you didn't?
I would say in the first 5 years, because remember, we had to start from a clean sheet of paper. We had no management there that had any real experience. We had to build the airline, and it took us 5 years to get to a point where we had enough structure in place, enough experience in place to get the company listed. which we needed to do because if we wanted to expand further, we really needed to start to get external investors involved to help fund the fleet growth. And I think that the business piece came around that time because Stelios and I and others, Chris, we were out pitching to the banks. We had a lot of contact with the banks, and I think at that stage and at the time of listing, we got a lot more exposure. There was a lot more publicity around to support the company's flotation. And at that stage, we could see the opportunity then of getting the business traveler. And they came in small numbers to start with. That was how it evolved. I don't think there was, I mean, what I was determined to do was not to create a special product for the business market, but basically it was the same offer that was being provided. But it was more of an acceptance that what we were providing was a product that was perfectly acceptable for short trips, for day trips or whatever, because we had very good frequencies. Just depended, of course, of whether the airports that we were using was convenient for them. So if they were living up north, for example, and our airports at Stansted or at Luton were convenient, rather than drive past them and go into London, it was practical for them just to hop off there. They got home earlier, could stay in bed a bit longer, or had a longer day working. So I would say that it grew. It took some time to grow, but certainly after flotation, it grew pretty quickly.
So, and you still think EasyJet may be going a little bit too far now with the kind of the frequent flyer programs, the priority boarding?
It's complex. It's business. It's much more complex than it used to be. And I think that I've seen this. I've been in the airline industry since I was 18. And you just see a sense over time that it's the same problem repeating, that everything's going well, people start spending more money on the product, there's a recession, and all of a sudden the airline's nearly bankrupt, or it is bankrupt and it's been sold off. So that's really a really devastating situation because a bankrupt airline loses the commitment of its customers, and also it's very demoralizing for the staff, particularly the ones that are laid off. So it's a good idea to avoid that. And having a balanced approach is really what's really needed here.
Okay. I like this one. It's a bit of a curveball, but Stelios has launched many easy brands over the years. None of them have been nearly as successful as EasyJet. Why is that?
Well, I mean, Stelios's idea, I wouldn't criticize the idea. I think the EasyJet clearly provided a platform to give an idea that maybe the Easy brand could be stretched, that by synergies could be created. I didn't get involved in that because my role was to run the airline, but at the same time I didn't have any objection to it because I thought that if he's out there spending money promoting Easy something else, it was probably going to have some positive impact on EasyJet, as long as those businesses didn't fall into disrepute. He assured me that wasn't going to happen. So good on him. He tried it. I mean, he came in without any experience in aviation, was prepared to get a lot of family money into the business to get it started, and the outcome was undeniably fantastic. So any entrepreneur is going to have a pretty high loss rate on projects that don't work against one or two that do work. So I think, on average, the size of the businesses that he was trying to create were quite small compared to the size of EasyJet, of course. EasyJet was just the right idea at the right time, made possible by the government's decision to deregulate the industry. And if it hadn't been for that, we wouldn't be an EasyJet or any other low-cost airline.
So it's choosing the right sector at the right time. To make that brand work. Yep. Not necessarily exactly. The brand will make every industry work.
And more importantly, first mover advantage. Yeah. So, you know, the airlines that have come in late have not been anywhere near as successful because the marketplace at that time, the potential marketplace for them is so much smaller, and it's very difficult for them to get to critical mass.
Okay, we've got another one here. This is a good question. Was there anything you wish you'd done or done better before you left EasyJet?
That's a good question, actually. I've never been in a job more than 5 years. In my earlier life in Air New Zealand, on average, it was probably 3 years before being promoted into another role. And so I established a principle that 5 years was it. I tend to have I'm good at handling a challenge, but I get bored when we're just into routine. So I've always set the target. 5 years is about as much as I can handle. And in the case of EasyJet, it was 10 years, but I explained that away by saying the first 5 years was a private company, and the next 5 years we were listed, so it was quite a different role that I was playing at that time. I wouldn't want to go on beyond that. I made that clear, and we agreed with the board. And I think that's right. I think that in some cases, perhaps in a company that's not growing quickly and is in a really stable environment, then a chief executive can probably stay there for quite a long time. The only problem with that is that the businesses can become somewhat stale and perhaps miss opportunities because it's sitting on the sofa and life as usual, let's have a cup of coffee type of thing. So I think it's healthy for businesses to have fairly frequent change of their top management. No single chief executive is going to have all the answers or get it right. There's going to be pluses and minuses. So I think evolution in the executive team is a very positive benefit to most companies that are certainly in private hands, and even more so, I guess, with large companies in private hands. But I think it's healthy also in public businesses.
I mean, do you think are there markets that you would have rather have gone into earlier, or are there destinations that you wish you had served, or routes that you'd done that you would have stretched a bit more? I mean, you were very quickly into Berlin and Schönefeld, and that was something that was growing very quickly in your time. And you look at that; that's changed hugely. France was another market where EasyJet would kind of have that first mover advantage over Ryanair.
Yes, yeah. Because the thing is that, you know, we had no real references at the outset, so it wasn't a matter of being able to sit back and say, well, this will do great. Low cost didn't exist before. We had no references, and so it was a matter of trial and error. So by going into a new route, we'd give it a couple of months, how's it looking, and we'd make a decision whether at that point in time, we'd leave it as it was, put more capacity in, or actually reduce capacity or come out altogether. So it was a matter of trial and error. There was no textbook that was going to tell us how we could estimate, if you like, the success in advance, because it depended on what the uptake was. It would depend on, you know, remember that we were offering fares that were hitherto not available anywhere, and so it's very difficult when you're trying to establish the demand, even in a small community, which may previously required a fare of maybe £120 to travel versus £10. What does a fare change of that magnitude do in terms of stimulating demand? It could be a yawn, oh, I'm not really interested in doing it, it's £10, I'll go and spend the £10 somewhere else. Or it could be a hugely untapped potential market, and within 2 or 3 months of operating, we've put on double the number of services. So we had those extremes and something in between as well. So it was a question of just trial and error. It was very, very difficult, as I say, to anticipate in advance how a market was going to respond.
Well, that's quite interesting to hear, given that we always think we have the right answer when we're presenting a traffic forecast or a business case to an airline.
Well, you can do that if you've got some statistics to support it, but if it's never been done before, then you really don't have that basis. Yeah.
So, final question, I think, and we have run out of time, but I think this is a good question. What is the right airport infrastructure for LCC? Dedicated low-cost terminal or one for all? Given the evolution that's gone on at Luton.
Yes, I mean, the ideal situation is a dedicated terminal because the processing, the fundamentals of low-cost is high utilization of all of your assets, the aeroplanes, and all of your people. And to do that, to achieve optimal utilization, you really have to be very, very slick on your turnarounds, on your maintenance, on the baggage handling systems, and so on. I mean, the point I mentioned before that, you know, our standard turnaround time when we started the business and when I left it was 20 minutes for an airplane turnaround. That included getting all the baggage off, making sure the cabin was clear, all the safety checks being done, and ready for the next departure. So 20-minute turnaround, you're using your pilots efficiently, using cabin crew efficiently, and importantly, using the aeroplane efficiently. To do that, you really have to have the airport set up for that. Ideally, also, we want short taxi distances to the runway. So, but at the same time, we're not talking about big aeroplanes, so you can have fairly small terminals, which enables better access to the runway. So low cost is all about optimization, the use of assets, getting a lot of flights per day out of the fleet and the organization. So that's really the trick. So it
getting
doesn't
the right
really
size
work.
Of terminal development for yep. the right size of growth
exactly.
for that business.
So that's the optimal. Unfortunately, a lot of I flew out of Paris and down here on EasyJet, and Paris Charles de Gaulle was anything but an optimal environment. So it's horses for courses. You know what you really ideally want, and you hope that you can get that as often as possible. But at the end of the day, you've got to decide whether Paris is a market that you can consider to be economic success or not, and try it, even if you have got problems. I mean, I have to say, my wife is French. She's Parisian. So, I mean, I have no problems at all at criticizing the French. I get a slap in the ear now and again, but she knows what I mean, that the French have a way of their own. They don't like to be told what they should be doing, and if they want to slow down a bit, they'll slow down. And I've never seen a couple of baggage loaders move bags so slowly as I saw yesterday. So that's life.
So it's fascinating to, it's been great talking to you. It's been fascinating for me to understand a little bit how focused you were on the operational aspects of it. The attention to detail that you went into. It was great to hear about the acquisitions and how the cultural needs had to be, or the cultural perspectives of the two businesses had to be the same. I find it interesting the way you talk about long haul, low cost, and that how it cannot be the mainstream of the market. And I find it interesting your comments about rail. And about the way that EasyJet's business may be going a little bit too far at the moment, and will it need a reboot and to come back to normal? And I think it was great that you started with the most important thing, which was perhaps entering a low-cost carrier at the right time, having the right moment to enter the market, and the fact that you needed to get the owner away from pricing as soon as you come into the business, I thought was beautiful. So, you know, I think it's amazing. You must feel very proud of EasyJet now. 193 aircraft, 28 bases, you know, 81 million passengers. And a lot of that is down to your 10 years at the helm of EasyJet. And I think you could be very proud of that.
It was me, you know, being part of it, but also having a fantastic team of people. Yeah. And, you know, one thing I'll just add at the end is that the great thing about a startup, you can get some very passionate people to join you with like-minded, you know, willing to give it a go, and they work long hours. They're very talented people, and we had a great team at EasyJet for that, for certainly in my tenure there. And virtually none of those people left the company in my time there. We're a very hard-working team, very dedicated, and it was a fantastic opportunity for me, and fantastic opportunity, for a lot of passengers, which I was delighted to see.
Well, I'm really pleased that it went the way it did, and I'm really pleased that you could come here and talk to us.
Thank you.
I hope you've all enjoyed that, and ladies and gentlemen, please show your appreciation for Ray Webster.